Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Rich Lenkov is from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Tina Martini's out this week. Antonio Romanucci is founding partner of Romanucci & Blandin. He's represented victims in the Las Vegas and Highland Park shootings, victims involved in civil rights cases, including the families of George Floyd, Tyre Nichols, Sonia Massey. There was some news there today. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. But today we're here to talk about Renee Good, whose family he's also representing. She was fatally shot by federal immigration officer in Minneapolis earlier this month. Thanks so much for coming back on with us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Lots to cover. What's the family's feeling? Obviously, they're in mourning. They've lost Renee Good. How are they now feeling after they saw what happened with Alex Preti? What's their impressions right now?
Well, their impression after what happened to Alex over the weekend, Rich, was absolute anger. You know, when something tragic happens, especially one that's unexpected, and it happens because of, needlessness and unnecessary, just like what happened to Renee, you think there's a lesson there, that the lesson would have been, okay, we need to pull back a little bit. We need to reset. We need to de-escalate. We shouldn't be encountering people with exaggerated violence and force. And then you saw it happen again just days later. They were angry because then they're saying, well, what happened to Renee happened, it happened in vain because nothing changed. So they were very angry.
Antonio, this is a legal program. We want to ask you some legal questions. One of them being, do you think that this establishes a pattern, right? When we saw the one shooting of your client's family member, and this is another fatal shooting of, you know, someone who is in the middle of all this, is one of your legal arguments that this is a pattern demonstrated by ICE officials?
So that's a very good question, because very typically, if this were a case that happened with state officials, let's pick on Minneapolis Police Department or Chicago Police Department or Cleveland Police Department, for that matter. You are right. Once we see a pattern developing or a practice, we're able to sue that municipality for that claim, for a pattern or practice or custom that violates people's constitutional rights. But we don't have that right here. The federal government has put hurdles on when you can sue the federal government. They created the rules on how to sue them, and we cannot sue them for a pattern and practice in this case.
Interesting distinction. How would you attack the assertion by the federal government that the officers acted in self-defense here, even though Hennepin County Medical Examiner ruled your Renee's death a homicide?
Well, first of all, I think we have to look at the video. I mean, I think the video was the most important thing in defense of self-defense. Because, you know, when the administration came out and said that the agents shot in self-defense, the protection of their life, the protection of others, Rich, I can guarantee you they were probably reading off of a 3x5 index card. That was a narrative that was given to them to make sure that they got it right. Because just because it's said or stated that the officer was in fear for his life or he was acting in self-defense does not make it true. That does not make it legally enforceable. What you have to look at is the totality of what happened. You have to look at the intent of the person that was shot. You have to look at, in Renee's case, the vehicle. Which way was it pointing? What direction was it going in? What was the speed of it? And then, of course, I think the most important factor here is the concept of officer-created jeopardy. And that's a fancy term of saying that a police officer should never place himself in harm's way. And that's not just something that's anecdotal or something that's just a good practice. That's a directive. Those are orders in police practice manuals that you never place yourself in harm's way, because then what happens? All that's left is for you to use deadly force in order to escape the exact danger that you placed yourself in.
So how do you overcome the assertion that it's easy to, in hindsight, criticize the work after we've seen videos from 1,000 different angles, 1,000 different times, but the standard of care really, or the standard that is set forth by the case law, is not what we would do from the comforts of our couch or our laptops, but what a reasonable officer would do in the same position as the officers in this case? What do you say to that?
That's very, very important to understand, because that is the standard basis for proof, and that is what a reasonable officer would do under those circumstances. And let's just say, would a reasonable officer shoot at somebody who is not creating any danger of death or harm? And the answer is absolutely not. And so you can't just have the officer being the one saying that he was reasonable in that circumstance. It comes down to, very typically, experts who come in and say, these are the police practices. This is what the standards are in policing. If the car is moving away from you, if the tires are pointed away from you and it's moving slowly and you're standing to the side of the car, well, then there's no chance. There's zero opportunity for that car to be a weapon, and therefore no reasonable police officer would shoot at a 90-degree angle at someone's head as that car is moving. So that is the standard that's employed.
And Tony, you represent, over the course of your illustrious career, you've represented literally thousands of family members who have been the victim or have lost people to the victim of crimes. You and I are frequently on the opposite sides of cases, which is okay. I respect what you do, but I want you to bring us inside, you know, the room with your clients. And when they hear that some of the highest officials in the federal government call Renee Good a domestic terrorist, when they call Alex Preddy a terrorist, a lunatic, when they say that he was brandishing a gun, that he was planning to assassinate officers, how does that make the families feel who are already, you know, still processing the loss of a loved one?
Well, you can imagine that when they hear, you know, what I consider to be slanderous terms, and if you don't mind, Rich, I'm not going to repeat any of them, because I promised the family that I would never repeat those slanderous words, even in an explanation or definition. But they are extremely hurt by it, because they know who Renee is. And we speak about Renee in present tense, because that's also what they want, because they carry her with her still every day. She was a mother. She was a daughter. She was a sister. She was a committed companion. She was an animal lover. She loved home cooking. She loved road traveling. And when they hear those pejorative, slanderous terms of somebody who really was all she was trying to do was exercise her right of First Amendment to peacefully assemble, to have freedom of speech, right? We're not talking about Alex here now, who also had a Second Amendment right, but Renee, only her First Amendment right to assemble and freedom of speech, and to be called those words without any evidence or basis in fact, and reach a conclusion without an investigation, it hurt them deeply.
All right, Antonio Romanucci of Romanucci and Blanett, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. Mitchell Eppner of Cudman, Trachten, Allow & Posner LLP in New York is a civil and criminal litigator with 30 years of experience in virtually all forms of litigation. He's represented tech leaders, pharmaceutical companies, filmmakers. He's had victories in the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's here to talk with us about captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his declaration in a New York federal courtroom that he is still the president of his country. Mitchell, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mitchell, since Maduro got captured, there's only been a couple of legal stories going on. It seems like almost a lifetime ago that this was topic number one, but we know that in Trump world, these things change every day. But still, really an incredibly important legal story, very interesting. So how does Maduro intend to win in court, both legally and perhaps from a public relations standpoint, when he eventually faces a trial?
So, Rich, I think you've asked some good questions, but part of the defense strategy here is to try to make it so that he never faces a trial. Their first argument is going to be that as the president of Venezuela, he is immune as a under foreign sovereign immunities law from this case, and that the case should be dismissed. Now, there are lots of issues embedded in that. The United States has contended for a long time that Maduro has not been the legitimate president of Venezuela. There are issues about, even if he is the legitimate president of Venezuela, whether that would protect him from prosecution. When you put it all together, the defense wants to try to get this case to either be dismissed or take forever in order to go to trial, because I would expect, haven't spoken to them, but his very able defense counsel probably recognize that if there's somebody different in the White House, there might be a very different attitude towards this prosecution.
So walk us through that, because it's really interesting. I think most of our listeners and viewers probably still don't understand how a U.S. government goes into a foreign country, being Venezuela, and literally under cover of dark, snatches up the president and brings him back to the U.S., and he's facing a judge within hours. What is the legal theory behind the prosecution there?
So let's start with the stuff that's easy to understand. There really has been an indictment of Maduro that's been pending for many years. They went back and they re-upped it recently within the last couple of months. But if Maduro had traveled to some place like the UK that has extradition with the United States, he could have been arrested and held to be extradited here. That's the easy part. The part that it really takes the Trump second administration to do is to say, well, we can go in with our military force and grab this person out of Venezuela. And I don't really have a good answer for why that was legal.
So that will undoubtedly be obviously the first line of defense. How receptive do you think the judge in this case will be to the argument that I shouldn't even be here in the first place? Forget about the substance of the charges. And then also talk about his wife. How does wife get snatched up also?
So she was added to the indictment, the recent indictment. She did not know she had been indicted based upon what was publicly available. I think as a practical matter, they decided that they were going to run this military operation. She was going to be there, so they indicted her so that they could grab her. It's very hard to get a case dismissed on the basis that I was illegally seized, because if the underlying charges are good, what would happen is even if somebody was released, the second they were released, they would just be grabbed on the courthouse steps. So courts are not receptive to, you can't, you, you have to let me go free. That one, and return back to Venezuela. That one, I don't think is likely to work because we grabbed him in the wrong way. I think that the argument that he's immune from this prosecution could work for him. I don't think that works for his wife, who, while she is a legislative leader in Venezuela, is not the head of state. Doesn't even argue that she is.
So what about this argument about, this worked with Manuel Noriega of Panama, you know, back in the 90s, and that's the precedent that the federal government is using. That case never got to the Supreme Court, but, you know, Noriega alleged that he was also immune from prosecution by a foreign government because he was the head of state. One difference, of course, is that, you know, he was a strong man, only a term you could use kind of on podcast perhaps, but he was not the elected president of Panama, whereas Maduro is the elected president of Venezuela. Obviously a different legal argument, stronger for Maduro, but, you know, the 11th Circuit ruled in that case that he was not immune from prosecution, right, in the Noriega case.
Right, and Rich, kudos to you, because you've clearly dug into this, and most people do not realize that Manuel Noriega was never the president of the United of Panama. There was another person who was his puppet, who literally had the sash that said El Presidente. And that was one of multiple reasons why the 11th Circuit and the district court said that Noriega's motion to be held immune based upon foreign sovereign immunity lost. There's also this multi-factor test under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act of 1976 that the Noriega court said meant that Noriega could be tried. It's not clear whether that law is constitutional. If you go all the way back to the Supreme Court case called Schooner, like the ship, but it was somebody's name, from the very earliest days of the Republic, there the Supreme Court said it's a one-step test. If somebody is the sovereign leader of a foreign country, they can't be put on trial here criminally.
Last question, Mitch, before we let you go on this really amazing insight, we really appreciate it, is I suppose another line of defense that Maduro's attorneys will mount is that this was an example of vindictive and selective prosecution by the government, particularly in that Trump has, you know, among the many explanations he's given is that this is about oil, that this will make, you know, life more affordable. He's trying to tie this to, you know, everyday Americans' lives in saying that, you know, Venezuela controls a ton of oil and now the U.S., you know, has control over that. I think it's a good argument that the defense will mount that, you know, are you arresting my client or are you prosecuting my client because of the indictment or because you want his resources? You want to strip his country of his resources. And the best way to do that is to capture the president. I mean, that's a pretty good argument, I think, on its face.
Rich, that's a great argument. And there are some things that add to that. One is that Trump literally pardoned a different president who was accused, the president of Honduras, who was accused of basically the same thing and being responsible for the importation of 400 tons of cocaine from Central America into the United States. And his basic explanation, Trump's basic explanation is, well, that guy's friendly to our country. He's a right-wing dictator. It's left-wing dictators that we don't like. That is really strong on the selective and vindictive prosecution front. There's also a motion that I expect will be made based upon what they'll call outrageous government misconduct, which is, you just arrested me in order to steal the oil. That is the sort of thing that under a different set of judges and Supreme Court justices might have a lot more likelihood of success. Under the six Tannies who are currently the majority on the Supreme Court, and the way they kowtowed to Trump in Trump versus the United States, granting him immunity even before he retook the White House, I do not have high hopes that that would be a winning argument.
Mitch, I know I said last question. I just have one more last question. As you know, something you said sparked my curiosity. What about the argument that it's impossible to get a fair trial? He's the president of a country that the president of our country has designated to be basically an enemy combatant. He has been paraded in front of the cameras. He has been called out personally by the president. His wife has been arrested. You know, I imagine that his defense will also be, how can I get a fair shake when I've already been indicted and convicted by the, you know, by the president of the U.S.? I mean, who hasn't seen these videos? Who hasn't heard, you know, Trump talk about this?
So, again, these are great points that you're making. And if I were the defense counsel, I would absolutely argue in each and every one of them. But Charles Manson was successfully prosecuted after Richard Nixon called him a murderer. The courts are very hesitant to say that somebody can't be tried. Sometimes they'll do a change of venue, like after the Oklahoma City bombing. They said, well, we can't try this person in Oklahoma, and they put the trial on in Denver. But there's nothing that particularly makes New York an emotional spot and for that's against Maduro. In fact, if I were defense counsel, New York would be one of the venues that most likely want to try the case. I would be much more concerned about being someplace where Trump is incredibly popular. Although these days, literally, that doesn't even include Florida, Texas, or Mississippi. I think Alabama would probably be the most likely venue that the feds would want.
Mitchell Epner of KTAP LLP, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, President Trump continues to say he wants to acquire Greenland. But what exactly does that mean? And is it constitutional? Michael Scharf is professor and associate dean for global legal studies at Case Western Reserve School of Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ryan, it's a pleasure.
So, Professor, after Davos, he came back, President Trump came back and said that there is, you know, a framework of agreement. He backed off this idea that he could acquire it by force or persuade them to sell it. But, you know, obviously it sparked a very interesting legal discussion, which is what right does the United States have to acquire Greenland by force? Could they, you know, is there a lawful mechanism by which they could acquire it without Greenland consenting? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, to start out with the situation at Davos, all switched over after Trump spoke with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. And Secretary General Rutte basically just explained to President Trump, look, you've already got extensive military rights under a Cold War era agreement that's still in effect. And although the United States only has one NATO base in a very small corner of Greenland, this agreement actually says that it can have its military bases throughout the island. It can put as many troops on the ground as it wants, and it can control militarily the island for the good of NATO. And so when Trump heard that, he's like, oh, sort of like Saturday Night Live, Emily Latella. Never mind. But despite that, let's just hypothetically say that President Trump starts talking again about, I want to acquire Greenland. I want that $4 trillion worth of rare earth minerals. I want to control the Northwest Passage and the Arctic. So we're going to seize it. Then we've got some legal issues to discuss.
Tell us what those are. What? Because Trump, we know, has already said that there is no such thing as international law. I mean, that's not true. Talk to us about what international law says about acquiring another country, especially one that is ruled by a NATO ally.
Yeah. So there is international law, and it is binding law in the United States, and we've respected it for 250 years. And the UN Charter, which is now 80 years old, says you can't invade another country. And although President Trump had a good time doing that in Venezuela, there's a lot of pushback. And Greenland, which is part of Denmark, is not Venezuela. If the United States militarily tries to seize Greenland, it will break NATO. and it will have repercussions that will affect the United States for decades or centuries. And it is, the risks are so high that it is unlikely that he'll actually pursue that, no matter what his whims might be at the moment.
Well, Trump has actually also said that Denmark's claim over Greenland is tenuous, right? That someone gave it to them a long time ago and they shouldn't have, and now it's up for grabs, something like that. I mean, what is the legal basis that Denmark has?
It's rock solid, Rich. So 300 years ago, Denmark colonized Greenland. And then there was an International Court of Justice decision in 1933 that confirmed that Greenland was part of Denmark, that Denmark was the sovereign. So this is undisputable. It's as crystal clear in international law as something can be.
What would happen? I mean, again, it seems thankfully to be now a hypothetical, but what would happen if we rewind now 2 weeks or so and Trump proceeded with military action against Greenland? I mean, you know, what would the international legal community do, and what authority do they have to act after that would happen?
Well, first of all, Denmark has a right of self-defense, but when a NATO country is attacked under Article 5 of the NATO agreement, all of the NATO countries have a legal obligation to come to that country's aid. And whether the United States and President Trump still cares about the NATO obligation, the other NATO countries do. And so what it basically means is that it would put us at odds against the very allies that for the last, you know, since World War II, we have had this very strong relationship. And it is the relationship that really has made our country what it is. Those are our partners. You know, there's an old saying that Rudyard Kipling once had. He said that a wolf pack's only as strong as its leader. You know, that might be the United States, but the wolf leader is only as strong as the pack. And without the NATO pact, the United States is really weakened. It's just the risks are so astronomically high. There's no way even President Trump will end up contemplating that. Now, what I think he might contemplate is an end round by buying the votes of the people in Greenland. And here's how he might do that. So Greenland has self-rule. And under a statute that Denmark passed three decades ago, the people in Greenland, there's 57,000 of them, they can vote in a referendum for independence. And if they do, it's the same thing with Quebec in Canada and Scotland in the UK. They can get independence. And once they're independent, if they want to merge with the United States or have a compact of free association like the United States has with Micronesia and Palau and some other countries in the Pacific, that could happen. Now, what would it cost the United States? My guess, if you gave each of those indigenous people who are very poor in Greenland $1 million each, I think they would probably consider that very strongly. Now, what would that cost us altogether? There's 57,000 of them. That's $57 billion. Is that too high a price? I mean, it's a lot of money, but not compared to an invasion, not compared to a major war.
Professor, yeah, it's great points. I know international law is your expertise, but if Trump invaded Greenland, it's hard to say those words, even though it's hard to imagine a world where we say those words still. But if Trump invaded Greenland, he would also obviously face some legal issues on the domestic front, right? I mean, we know that presidents routinely ignore Congress's power to declare war when there's an imminent threat. It's sort of the unsaid permission slip. But there's certainly no imminent threat that would warrant the president going to war with Denmark over, you know, acquiring Greenland. So he would have some major issues constitutionally on the domestic front, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think the entire military that is in Greenland right now is about 12 people. So it could be like a very quick intervention, in which case the president would say, this isn't a war. You know, this was just like a little blip. But depending on how the NATO allies respond, it could get really messy. And I think the political issue is the real issue. You know, Trump will say, I'll put tariffs on you if you don't do what I want. Well, they're going to put tariffs on us too. And we cannot just cut off all of our trade with Europe. It's too high a price. And Canada, by the way, which is also part of NATO,
right.
Which is our number one trading partner in the world. And because of that, Congress, I believe, will stand up. This is the red line that they will draw. This is the one time they'll finally say, and all it takes is basically peeling off five Republicans. And they're just going to say, you've gone too far. And they can easily pass legislation that says, no, you cannot invade, you cannot intervene, you cannot occupy a NATO country illegally.
Professor, before we let you go, we got to talk about what's really important. Star Trek. I know you're a Trekkie or a Trekker, depending on which fan base you call yourself, but you've authored lots of important works dealing with the interconnection between Star Trek and international law. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I have to say, I wrote an article 30 years ago about how professors could use Star Trek The Next Generation episodes to teach international law. And it has become the most famous thing I've done, even though I published 21 books, won 5 national book awards, and I'm happy about it. So it's the 60th anniversary of Star Trek, and it's a better system of international law on that show because the Federation actually takes the law to heart. So happy that you mentioned that.
Rich, are you a big Star Trek guy?
I am not, although, you know, I'm maybe an OG Star Trek guy. William Shatner, Captain Kirk, is a fellow alum of McGill University. He's a fellow Montrealer, so a fan of Captain Kirk.
Right, I'm going to show you guys something real quick. So when my article came out, I had it signed.
Oh, wow.
By the cast of Star Trek.
Look at that.
This is Leonard Nimoy. This signature is probably worth quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Who else you got on there? You got Uhuru?
I got them all. I got, you know, William Shatner. He's still around, but he's been in outer space.
Yeah.
So
that's incredible.
That's fantastic stuff. Well, I'm glad you're still getting some play out of that. And it's fun. It's got to be fun for the students as well. Yeah, I mean, do the students connect, do you think, with Star Trek these days?
I think they still do because every couple of years there's a new Star Trek series. And once again, there's, you know, Star Trek Academy that all of them are watching. And it's the talk of the water cooler in the mornings.
Unbelievable. All right, Professor Michael Scharf with Case Western Reserve School of Law. If you want to check up on your Star Trek, that's the place to go. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Take care, guys.
Professor, live long and prosper.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by Rachel Fizay, co-founder and managing partner of RFZ Law in Los Angeles. Repeat guest. You can see her popping up on CBS. She's been on News Nation. She's been all over the place, and I believe you are the F in RFZ, correct?
Yes. Correct.
Okay. All right, and in this corner, Senior Vice President of Claims based in New Jersey, Dana Applegate, first-timer. Thank you, Dana. We'll try to be as gentle as possible. So if you want to come back, because that's what we need. We need you to come back.
Well, I am from Jersey, Ryan. So, you know, I can put up a good fight.
Come back, queen. You got it. All right, let's get to the bag. Rich, we start with Trump Watch and the president's war of words with the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, over his deployment of federal agents to that city. And of course, the two fatal shootings in just a matter of weeks, Rich.
Yeah, we just covered that, of course, with Anthony Romanucci, Antonio Romanucci. You know, I mean, this is going back and forth, of course. We've seen a couple of meetings between the administration and leaders in Minnesota, Rachel, where they've described it as good meetings. Although, you know, this latest salvo between the mayor, Frey, and the president raised, you know, an interesting legal issue that we want to cover here, which is whether it is what Trump called a very serious violation of the law is accurate when the mayor of Minneapolis said that they will not enforce federal immigration laws. You know, of course, Trump, not knowing a damn thing about the law, said that that is a violation of the law. But, you know, no other authority than Antonin Scalia has already ruled on this many years ago when in a case called Prince versus the United States said that the federal government may not compel the states to enact or administer a federal regulatory program. So it turns out that the mayor of Minneapolis is probably accurate in saying that they will not enforce this federal program going on in his city.
Yeah, it's when you can rely on a Scalia opinion for civil rights, I'd say that you've got a real problem on your hands. But that's what's going on here in Minneapolis. And it's been ruled on courts over and over again that these cities can elect not to assist the federal government. They are under no obligation to assist the federal government in these types of regulatory programs. And that's what Minneapolis is doing. It's kind of what we hear of as sanctuary cities, and sanctuary cities are being upheld by most courts. So I don't think we have a serious violation of the law as it relates to not assisting in what some might call unlawful federal practices right now.
Yeah, and we know data, of course, that whatever, you know, side of this you sit on, what Trump is doing is not really rooted in a sound legal argument, but more of a PR campaign, which he does very effectively, right? I mean, this is kind of right out of the Trump playbook in, you know, sort of acting first and then worrying about the legal repercussions afterward.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no consideration, I think, for him on what the legal repercussions are, because I think he believes he establishes what they are, right? That he has the power to establish that. But, you know, it's an interesting one because, you know, the feds have multiple departments within the DHS that are explicitly responsible for enforcing federal immigration laws. So I do find it a little entertaining that Trump is so bothered by the Minneapolis mayor coming out and saying that, right? Like, I mean, I just think it's, you know, if Trump was really going to take a strong position on this, why not say, well, we got it covered. We don't need your help. You know, look, I agree with the mayor. I agree with Frey. You know, their first order of business is protecting the general public. If I were a citizen of Minneapolis, I would want my police force focused on kind of safety and crime prevention and protecting the rights. You know, I think it was after the George Floyd incident, you know, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, that they updated, the city of Minneapolis updated their oath that the police officers take, you know, first do no harm, you know, upholding the safeguard and sanctity of life. So listen, I think he's standing up at a time when other people would be sitting down and being quiet. And, you know, I think it's great. I think he should stick to his position. And, you know, I think that Trump should focus on funding his own agendas and not looking for cities to fund them.
Right. Ryan, I know that your newsroom has covered extensively over the last few hours the latest video that was released showing the altercation between Alex Pretty, who was shot in Minneapolis, and federal officers 11 days before the shooting. You know, from a legal perspective, what we're thinking about is whether that will affect a decision whether to charge the officers involved in the shooting that resulted in his death. You know, I don't know the correlation between the two. I mean, number one, that assumes that an actual investigation is happening. You know, the administration has pledged that an investigation is ongoing. Who knows whether that is the case after how Kristi Noem has dealt with it. But, you know, I don't know even if this video from 11 days prior does show Alex Pretty as the aggressor. In that case, he kicks out the lights of a police vehicle, whether that will affect the decision as to whether to charge the officers that ended up killing him. I don't know. What's the talk around the newsroom there?
You know, we're just trying to piece it all together. I mean, this video from weeks prior, you know, we didn't know who Alex Pretty was, and all of a sudden this video shows up. So yeah. We honestly don't know, and we don't really know who to ask to see how it's going to be prosecuted. And we did find out from News Nation that, you know, we know that these officers have been put on essentially administrative leave, which they would normally have been put on. And we don't know what their future is in these roles following the shooting aspect of this Pretty encounter, I should say.
Yeah. And Rachel, we'll move on. But I mean, just on this topic, it's such an interesting legal question. You know, I assume that we've already heard from lots of people who are, you know, defending the administration, saying this shows what I think someone said the psychopath Alex Pretty was, and this shows that the officers were justified in doing what they do. You would have to establish some kind of nexus between the two, almost that the officers in the second altercation were aware of the first video, which, unless it's the same officers, is complete nonsense, right?
I think almost every day of the week that evidence stays out of court.
Yeah.
Because it absolutely has no bearing on the encounter where he was shot.
Right.
So I think that is not relevant evidence in the case relating to his shooting. So, yes, if these officers are charged, that they're trying to get that in, but it has no bearing on what the incident was when he was shot. So, yeah, I think this is a red herring, and they're grasping at straws every which way they can.
Well stated.
Let's go to Texas, though, where the jury found a Uvalde school security guard not guilty of abandoning students when that gunman entered the school and killed 19 kids and two teachers in 2022, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the bigger mass shootings, unfortunately, that we've seen, 19 kids, two children were killed in Uvalde, Texas. This was the trial of an officer, one of two trials. There's still one pending of the chief of police. And Dana, the prosecution argued that the officer abandoned basically his post by not going in. I think there was 117 rounds that were fired before this individual, Gonzalez, made an attempt to neutralize the attacker. There were 77 minutes between the time that authorities arrived and that a team was able to get into the classroom and kill the shooter. Of course, he was only one of many officers who were involved. But the allegation here was that, you know, he should have acted quicker. There was a lot of testimony. In fact, some testimony was kept out of where he was in relation to the shooter, you know, whether he was in the hallway or close enough to attempt to shoot the shooter. Jury came back after a long deliberation and decided that he was not guilty. We don't know why. I haven't seen any quotes from the jury yet, but, you know, the defense argued that this was merely scapegoating, right? That the true person responsible was the shooter who was killed. And this was the prosecutor's attempt to maybe, you know, get some relief for the family. So, you know, we'll see how the second trial goes. There might be more liability for the police chief, given how many people arrived and, you know, how much time elapsed between the two of them. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, horrible, tragic event. But to blame the police officer on site in a chaotic, uncertain situation, up against a shooter that has likely meticulously planned to carry out this event, I just think it's misplacement, right? It's misplacement of blame in that situation. And I come from a family that has several law enforcement members in it. And, you know, look, they're trained on this. They're trained to make these split second judgments. But training in a controlled environment and being out in reality, where there's a lot of different factors at play, you know, the noise, that, you know, everything else that is going on at that particular moment, you know, it's really hard to judge that in hindsight. I mean, I think kudos to the jury, because I don't think that, you know, we want to kind of live in a society where we say, you know, if he would have acted 1 minute sooner, he would have saved all of these, you know, children and the teachers. I mean, it is tragic. And I cannot remember. And I remember distinctly, you know, when this happened, because my daughter was like around the same age as the kids involved there. You know, she's 13 now. I think this was what, like 3-4 years ago or something. And so, you know, it's just the heartache, right, of trying to be in that position of those parents. But at the same time, you know, these officers are putting their lives on the line every single day, and their whole purpose is to protect and serve. And I think that, you know, I can't imagine what this situation was like. And, you know, it's, again, it's tragic and it's horrible. But I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the chief of police, because I think he has a little bit different standards, right, than the on-site officer. That should be interesting. I think, you know, the prosecution is going to use a lot that they learned, obviously, from this trial and make some adjustments for the next one. I guess we'll see what happens in the next one. I'm definitely going to stay tuned on that.
I mean, Rachel, Dana raises an interesting point in many ways, one that we've been talking about in Minneapolis, which is that, you know, hindsight, it's easy in hindsight for many of us to argue that we should have acted differently than the police. But the standard, actually the legal standard, is what a reasonable officer would do in those few seconds. The difference between Minneapolis and Uvalde, though, the prosecution argued, is that 77 minutes passed, right? We're well beyond this sort of split-second decision-making. They had 77 long minutes to engage, and they didn't.
Yeah, and I think that is where the police chief comes in. I think the that's going to be a different analysis. And these criminal charges are really pretty difficult, I think, because the standard is so high. When you're basically talking about negligence, it's just the stakes were so high. So this is what's going on here. And I agree with Dana. I think that these are tough calls. Yes, people were not doing their job well. But what that rises to and who can be blamed for a mass shooter, it becomes a more difficult challenge when you're talking about the murder of children and somebody not effectively carrying out their job. I do believe there's blame here, and there's places to go with this blame when you're talking about mass shooters, but I don't know that it's to go to the police officer on site. Yes, the chief of police raises that he should have been doing more. And again, we have to just figure out where that line is, who can be blamed.
Yeah, I want to get Ryan involved because, Ryan, actually, this is a topic that is very close to you. You have actually covered 10 mass shootings. You had a great podcast called Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting. I'm doing your job for you,
thank
by
you.
The way, Ryan.
Appreciate this it. Is I usually love the cross podcasting.
Yes, but I want to get your insight because, you know, I mean, listen, I hear what Dana and Rachel are saying, but my feeling is that part of any prosecutor's duty is to send a message, right? To create an environment where this doesn't happen again. And I don't know if we're sending the right message to the next police force by giving this officer a walk. I don't mean to say that, you know, insensitively, but, you know, what message does it send to someone who waits 77 minutes? And it's one of the worst mass shootings we've seen. And we just, you know, allow that to happen because we thought he acted reasonably. It's one thing if it's a couple of seconds or a few minutes, but to me, 77 minutes is a big differentiator.
Rich, I think the evidence showed that the officer only waited 3 minutes. It was 77 minutes before they got, you know, kind of the task force and, you know, the other teams in place. That was what took 77 minutes, but he was inside within like 3 minutes, but they were saying even that was too long, even though, you know, that rifle that this shooter was using, it shot off those 117 rounds within 2 minutes, they said. This was like a super high powered rifle. So, you know, anyway, sorry, I just wanted to kind of, that's, you know, again, I think there's a difference here between the on-site officer and the chief of police and
you know,
that 77 minute lapse, but I don't think that was the on-site guy.
And I just wanted to throw in there that it was just a few years ago that the Parkland school security officer, that his charges were also, he was cleared. He was found not guilty over his failure to confront the gunman in the Parkland situation. So, Rich, to your point, I mean, we've seen prosecutors going after parents, right? Especially in school shootings. We saw that in Oxford, Michigan. We saw it in Georgia. But doesn't seem to be so much about the policing. Now, that being said, police have really stepped up their training in these kind of situations. And, you know, there's a big difference, too, between rural situations and urban situations and the kind of training. One point I did want to make, though, is speaking actually to the man who broke up the Club Q shooting and is actually deemed to be a hero. He was military, ex-military, saw the shooter and actually tackled him and beat him up. He said that, you know, even in his military training, you don't know, you can train years and years and years, but until you're in battle, you don't know how you're going to respond. And he was in Iraq and he saw people he trained with, as soon as there was gunfire, hightail it out of there or find a secret spot or hide. And so you don't know in those situations how you're going to respond. And he said in many of those cases, they don't even know what they're doing, that their bodies respond. They physically can't do the thing that they've trained to do. So yeah. I don't know, maybe juries in this case see that as a possibility. All right. I want to go to TikTok now because it's the online giant has settled with in an addiction lawsuit, social media addiction lawsuit. Rich, this is the second of a handful of these lawsuits involving this plaintiff in particular and some major social media platforms.
Yeah, we've covered a lot of this. We've had a couple of lawyers who represent families of victims. This one was interesting because, you know, the victim in this case, who is only identified as KGM, she's a 20-year-old woman. You know, her damages, I mean, she didn't, you know, kill herself, thankfully, which is the case with many of these lawsuits. The estates bring, the parents usually bring a lawsuit. That's some of the stories we've covered. In this case, you know, the allegation was that she, her addiction to TikTok caused her to experience anxiety and depression and body image issues. So, you know, the case settled. I think some of these social media platforms are less inclined to settle when there is a death or a suicide because the stakes are a little higher. On the other hand, those cases do involve lots of notoriety and, you know, these platforms don't want that either. But, you know, I think that it continues to raise serious questions, Rachel, as to the culpability, the responsibility of online platforms. We haven't seen yet the sort of smoking gun memo that we've seen in tobacco litigation, for example, in which the companies know that their product is addictive and they are, you know, engineering the algorithm to play on that. But we know that already. We know that it's almost way more addictive than nicotine. So inevitably that evidence will come out. We all know from ourselves, we're all addicted. There's no one on this, you know, Zoom that is not addicted to these platforms, and the algorithm is designed to make you continue. But whether that means that they are responsible for depression, anxiety, that's yet to be proven. One of these cases will go to trial. We'll see some of that evidence.
Yeah, so I think Snapchat and TikTok got themselves out of this trial. It's happening here in LA, and I think it's because there's thousands behind it and they don't want the liability finding. So they're just ticking them off, if you will, one by one to make sure there's not this bellwether case that finds this liability. It will happen at some point. There will be a finding, whether it's liability or not liability, it will go through. And there is a huge amount of risk because there is so much evidence that it is addictive, that it's bad for kids, that they're not doing enough and that they know it. Now, where does the line between parental responsibility and the social media companies happen? There's a lot going on. And you have to then accept like social science, addiction, depression as hard science, just as you had to accept tobacco and cancer coming together and all the effects of the advertising on that. So it's a fascinating case. I have a master's in media effects. I assure you all of this is bad for people, but what happens beyond what happens and how the jury digests it is one thing. We had a really interesting conversation last night with my teenagers about it. And their role was like, where are the parents? Why aren't the parents keeping them off? And so it's just, it's like fascinating because there are all these, it's like a pie of what would be happening if somebody's scrolling. How much is the scrolling? How much is the addiction? How much does it take to get you over the hump to be depressed? Is it, you know, an hour a day? Is it 13 hours a day? So there's a lot of things that will have to be shown inside of this trial. And I'm here for it. I think it's fascinating.
Same. And Dana, you know, I don't think you could think of these kind of cases without thinking of the nicotine litigation. The difference there, and, you know, I talk to a lot of juries, is, you know, if you're on a jury of a nicotine case back in the day, you either smoked or you didn't. The jury in this case all are on social media, right? And you have to convince them to Rachel's point that, you know, someone else is responsible for all of this when they in those seats will know that they're on this all the time and their kids are on this all the time. And they'll have to look inwards and think, well, am I doing a good job as a parent? You know, if I'm assigning liability to these companies, what does that say about me? Am I just shirking my responsibility? So there's a lot more at play here with social media on trial.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's like these algorithms are, you know, being treated as the product liability, right? Which is really interesting. I think that it's also, you know, it's the causation piece, right? That'll be, if this goes to trial and we start to hear more about this testimony, right? They talk about the algorithms and we all know that they're intended to keep you in longer. But there's also a choice of the viewer on what they're actually looking at. And so I think, you know, you got to come down. It's really going to come down to that, right? What caused these thoughts and feelings? And was it actually the addiction piece that the algorithm is accused of, you know, professing? Or is it the choice of the content? Because if you're scrolling through watching, you know, happiness, roses, butterflies, and kitty cats cuddling all day, then maybe you have, you know, different feelings than if you're watching other content. So, you know, yes, of course, the parental thing is in there. And we all know, you know, as parents, it's hard, right? That's hard to control that all the time, because it's not just your control when they're with their friends and what they're seeing and, you know, a variety of other things. So, I mean, this is interesting. You know, when I'm reading this and the thousands of plaintiffs and, you know, this is another kind of bellwether issue, like I'm having PTSD about, you know, is this the next latent toxic tort to come, right? Is this like asbestos, like 4.0 or something? Because it just feels like this is going to go on, right? This is not going to stop. And I don't think we're going to become a communist country where, you know, things are banned. So this is going to be an interesting to watch for sure. Plenty more to come on this topic.
Yeah. Give me my money, right? Make this class action. Give me my money. Instagram, give me my money. But I feel like I got addicted somehow. And right. I want my check now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let me start this way. Well, all right. Matthew McConaughey is taking on AI companies by trademarking himself, Rich.
Yeah. I mean, not exactly the first case of its kind, but almost. I mean, in this way, you know, he's really the first celebrity to trademark his own license, himself. And the idea here, what he's trying to do, Dana, is to prevent the unauthorized use of his likeness by AI. You know, we've seen Scarlett Johansson fight this. We've seen some others. But the idea here is that he's not saying that it shouldn't be used, because that's really inevitable. What he's saying is that if it's used, he wants to be compensated. You know, and increasingly we're seeing, and we saw this as a big fight with SAG-AFTRA and the Hollywood studios. They've been fighting on this issue forever. It was a cause of the strike in 2023. I mean, AI is coming. We all, it's not coming. It's here. The idea that you can use someone's name and likeness and, you know, create commercials. Tom Hanks recently said that some of the ads you're seeing is just not me. So I think it's going to continue to be used. Whether actors like McConaughey will be successful in recovering for it depends on how likely the courts are to enforce these trademarks. But it's certainly a first step. I think it's the right first step. It's one that a lot of actors will do. You know, we know that McConaughey has, you know, tons of iconic film moments. The most, you know, probably overused is the "All Right, All Right, All Right" from Dazed and Confused. So, interestingly, though, ironically enough, he actually is an investor in a company called 11 Labs, which is used, among other things, for voice and likeness. It, you know, uses AI for voice and likeness. So he knows where he's coming from.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, as you kind of touched on, you know, this is all about consent and compensation, right? That's what this comes down to. And you know, definitely, I think we're going to see a lot more out there. It's a really interesting approach. I mean, where does it end? You know, should I go and start trademarking some of my, you know, video and audio clips of, you know, podcasts and speeches and keynotes and things like that, right? Like, where does it end? So it will be interesting to see where this goes. I mean, look, you know, they talk about, oh, preventing them from stealing his likeness. Trademarks don't prevent anything. They just make it a consequence if you do it, right? So, I mean, they're still going to do it. I think, you know, there'll still be limitations pushed on this. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this one goes.
And, you know, Rachel raises so many interesting questions. I mean, if he's able to protect, you know, that one phrase, what about the writer? What about the director? What about everyone else involved in the production of that film, right? I mean, you know, get in line for people who should be compensated.
I think it's going to be, I think we're going to find a new line of law as it relates to AI. And so this is just the first little branch that's happening, because I think this has not played itself out exactly. It has in some instances, like in pornography, that kind of thing. But as to the likeness of celebrities and how good AI is at this point, I think this will be fascinating to see. And the way it will play out is likely somewhere in the middle of what you can trademark and enforce.
was playing around with AI this week to see if you can take a script and turn it into generate a like a clip or a movie or like a scene or something like that. And all of these options came up where you could take your head or your picture and someone else's picture and put them together, and you could see what a baby would look like if you had a baby together. So you could take Matthew McConaughey's face and your face and see what if you had a child with Matthew McConaughey, what it would look like. And they also had these weird things like you could put your face and see what it would look like if you were kissing each other or hugging each other. And I'm trying to think, like, what scenario would this be useful for? And then I'm like, I got a teenage daughter upstairs who I'm sure would love to take a picture of her high school crush, her, put it together, see what a kid would look like. See, you know what I mean? It's weird and wild stuff. And I don't know, there's a whole new generation that's going to use it in a completely different way. All right. Contract disputes among professional athletes are pretty common. But now we're starting to see it at the college level, thanks to the NIL money. Rich, you got this story about Duke's quarterback.
I mean, we're covering lots of pioneering legal stories. This is all part of the brave new world where we are. And this in the sports arena, Rachel, is important because Darian Mensah is a quarterback, a highly recruited quarterback. He signed a two-year NIL deal. It's important to understand this was an NIL deal. This was not an employment contract with the school. This was a deal to license his name, image, and likeness with the with Duke University. Ironically, his name is Mensah. Duke is a pretty smart population. And he broke the deal, allegedly, and when he agreed to transfer in the transfer portal to Miami. Duke sued and said that, wait, we have a deal. You agreed to play for Duke for 2 years and you're going to get compensated. And his response, we think, was that, well, I have the right to transfer. I have the right to decide where I'm going to work or play football. It's common to transfer. But that still leaves a contract, right? And I think the legal question, one that wasn't decided here because the parties settled, but that has to be decided at some point, is to what extent can Duke enforce this contract? Is it an employment contract, first of all? Well, no, because he's not an employee yet. That hasn't been decided. Then what was agreed to? Well, he agreed to license his name, image, and likeness to Duke. Well, does that mean that he has to play for Duke? No, I think that would mean, logically, that if he went to another school, then that deal is done. It's null and void. He didn't agree to play for Duke, his defense goes. He agreed to just let Duke, you know, use his name, image, and likeness. The contrary is, well, how would we ever have a valid contract if we're going to sign someone to a record deal, right? This was 2 years. Was it $8 million? It was a large amount. How are we going to have the certainty that that contract will be upheld? If you're just going to jump to the next deal, then that's not fair. Ultimately, the parties settled. I imagine Miami, who is the ranking number two, you know, they were the runner-up to the national champion, Indiana. I imagine they spent a lot, you know, they gave Duke a lot of money in return. But one of these cases will be litigated. Really interesting legal questions.
It is. It's fascinating. And I, as a former college athlete, I kind of hate what's happening to college sports at this moment because it is the Wild West. But at the same time, the athletes that, you know, the school's making so much money on the athletes. So what happens in my mind is like, what's the priority? Yeah, if he signed a contract, but it should always flow with where he's playing. And so is that the way it is? And it feels like the actual sport of it and his ability to move schools for all the reasons that people have always transferred when they're, you know, in their early 20s and in college, including coaches and where they want to play, got a little lost. I'm with you. Duke can use his name for another year. Sure, he doesn't play there, but he did the year before, so they get to use it. If they didn't somehow hash this out at the time of forming this contract, which it sounds like they did not. So I think this at least raises the issue for when other people are building these contracts to at least put it in what happens. I mean, that's the crazy part is how was this not contemplated at the time of making the contract?
It's a great point. You know, it's like caveat emptor, right? I mean, like if you're drafting a contract that doesn't contemplate a star recruit leaving, then it's a dumb contract. Dana, I mean, very legal term, very legal term. Dana, you know, listen, you always look at in these situations in contract, especially what the damages are, because you can have a great contract, dispute every day, but if there's no damages, then it's kind of, useless. In this case, Duke is alleging irreparable harm is the term they used, which I think is a valid, damages claim when you recognize that the number one team, the team that Miami, who now has this quarterback, lost to Indiana, they went from being, a doormat in college football to the national champion, undefeated, largely on the back of best player in the country, Mendoza, Heisman winner, who, transferred into Indiana and took that program to where they are, in addition to the coach and some other players. But I think the damages claim is real.
Yeah, I think, I think Duke was – I have two sides of, Duke being smart and then Duke being dumb. The smart move was the multi-year contract, right? Looking for a little bit of stability, more money-making opportunities by signing that two-year deal. They were dumb by not having that breakup clause, right? And I just don't even understand why you don't have that in something like this. I mean, all contract relationships are great until they're not. And you're always looking at what is that, exit ramp look like, right? How expensive is it? How long is it? And the fact that they didn't have the foresight for that, I mean, I would like to volunteer to Duke that I'm available if they need somebody to review contracts for them, because, that's just kind of an easy miss there. And look, I was surprised that they went after him and not, why not go after Miami too and be like, well, then you got to pay for this, right? We have his likeness and everything. So now, you're going to be owing us money every time you put his name on a shirt or something. I don't know. I just, it was an interesting concept. But again, I think they're also trying to make a point, just like in some of these other cases we've talked about today. The madness.
The answer to you raise a great question. Why not go after Miami? The answer is because there's no rules. This is still the NCAA has established no rules for what Miami does in this situation, how liable they are. They weren't a signatory to the contract, of course. So there's really no, but to your point, there's, unjust enrichment, there's inducement, who knows if they were talking to him before, in the normal business world, there'd be lots of actions against Miami, but the fact that there's no rules out there shows how kind of, there needs to be some regulation of this.
Yeah.
Like to see some four-year contracts so these guys actually stick around for a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
Attorney billing rates are going up and up and up, and one of the top law firms is now charging $4,000 an hour. Rich, I got into the wrong business.
I mean, you and me both. Oh, wait, I am in this business. This is like a great story and a awfully depressing story for a couple of reasons. I run a business, a law firm, and we're doing pretty well. But I do insurance defense. I do work with people like Dana. I'm struggling to get little rate increases every year, and I'm begging the clients. And then suddenly I see $4,000 an hour is the new rate for this one law firm. Dana, please tell all your friends what a bargain attorneys like me are in the world that we live in. Because, man, I'd love to get, $4,000 or even the previous record holder, which was last year, which we covered, which was $3,250. That's a pretty good rate. I don't think you're going to pay it, but this was for some of the, top types of law. The great thing is, I don't know if you read the quotes, but I love the fact that the attorney said that this is the best. This is one of the best quotes we've ever covered on Legal Face-Off. Not only is he not hiding from this $4,000, he said, if anyone out there is charging a higher rate, tell me because I want to go even higher. It's the greatest.
I mean,
it's the greatest flex in history.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I mean, I saw that. It made me laugh out loud for sure. Look, even he admitted, though, right, that, most of his deals are contingency or flat fee based. So, number one, I'm just going to go on the record and say what you say your hourly rate is and what you actually get paid as an hourly rate are two different things. So I'm just going to call him out on the flex a little there. But look, he's a parachuter, right? He comes in the 11th hour. He comes in on bet the company cases, not saying 4,000 is justified because, Rich, we go for bet the company cases and we parachute attorneys into cases all the time on our insurance cases. No one's getting paid $4,000 an hour. He's lead on Live Nation, right, for the Astro World thing. I'd like to know what he's getting paid on that. I don't think he's getting $4,000 on that. But in any event, it's I don't know what to say. That's crazy. You and I, we kind of had this conversation in December. We had it recently, so this was really timely. It definitely made me think about we've been talking about these crazy rates and insurance defense rates being too low. And, even though I'm on the insurance defense side, on the carrier side, I agree that I think in most instances they're too low. So this is a tough one. I feel for you for sure. I mean, I think the good news is that, it said that attorney rates were up like 7% in 2025. So, there's that.
It's funny. Yeah, that's true. And it's funny, Rachel, because Dana and I recently saw each other in Miami at a conference, and we discussed in a large room full of attorneys and people like Dana in the risk insurance world about rates and how, it's a market where good attorneys are hard to find. And you got to pay lawyers what they are worth. And I'm glad to see that someone is living up to it. Our friend Neil Manny, who, by the way, we got to get on Lisa, we got to book Neil for the podcast and get a little more information, especially because Rachel will get you in a second. His second quote was, this is even better. The process by which Bill's and mine billing rates are set each year is as mysterious as a papal conclave. So basically, F you. We're not telling you how we come up with these rates.
This is a reminder that I need to send out a letter to my clients raising rates for 2026.
Attach this.
Everything is reasonable. We're going to do a 400% increase.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
The subject line will be, I'm less than $4,000 an hour.
I think all these kids coming out of law school are going to think their loans are going to be paid off in like a year. We got to set the record straight here.
A year. You get a week.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
By the way, this podcast, I'm charging my new $4,000 an hour rate. This podcast just cost about $203.
There you go. Who are you charging that to? That's what I want to know. I'm getting
Ryan
nervous.
Burrow. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, to change your mind on that, let's talk about actress Sydney Sweeney. She apparently hung bras over the Hollywood sign, and you need to have a license to do that. I don't know why she couldn't use AI. She could be in some legal hot water now.
Well, it depends on whether the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce changes their position and decides to file a police report for trespassing or vandalism. Yeah, she was kicking off a campaign for her new Amazon-backed Rachel lingerie line. Siren? S-Y-R-N. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. Oh, my God. See? Siren. No wonder. She crept up to the Hollywood sign. There's video of her and her team getting out of a van in the dark of night and covering the Hollywood sign, the iconic Hollywood sign, with bras to promote her line. And, the police have announced currently there is no investigation. There is no crime. I guess there could be one. She said she had a license to film. Perhaps she didn't have a license to engage with that sign, which, talking about IP, is some of the most literally famous IP in the world. You think there's any liability, any chance that she'll get prosecuted, Rachel? Or has she already won because of the amount of free media she's gotten from all of this?
I think she's won. So it depends on who, is composed in that Hollywood Chamber of Commerce. Is it a group of straight men? I think she's safe. people do get prosecuted for vandalizing the Hollywood sign. That's the only issue here I see, is because it is vandalized quite often and there are prosecutions quite often. So why would she not be? Now, she could take down the bras. There's really no lasting damage to it. That would be the difference I see. But she can pay any fine, I think, by the press she has gotten by doing it. So all told, probably a good move on her part. And I think at this point, unlikely to be prosecuted.
Many would say, Dana, that the real crime committed by Sydney Sweeney was not using the Hollywood sign without a license, but that latest boxing movie she put out. I'm not sure if anyone saw it, but perhaps she should be prosecuted over having us endure that 97 minutes. But you think there's any chance the prosecutors go after Sydney Sweeney?
I didn't see the movie. And so based on your recommendation, I might skip that one. Look, if they go and inspect, like, you know, Rachel is saying, if somebody from the Chamber of Commerce sends somebody to go inspect and they find damage and they want to kind of, you know, get some newsworthy stories out of this, they might go after her. Listen, this is a simple one, right? Just get the darn right permits. I mean, it's kind of silly. You're in this field, right? There's production permits, there's filming permits, there's, you know, touching, climbing permits, whatever you want to call them. And so it's, you know, get the right ones. And so I would just say, hey, listen, if she used a production company and they got the wrong permit or didn't, you know, ask clarifying questions about which permits they needed for what they were planning to do, you know, she can go after them, right? She can just transfer her liability to somebody else, whoever went after the permit. So and I think she's good no matter what.
And well, as we've seen with the jeans, you know, she's a master marketer, right? Because you know what we really need? An excuse to see Sydney Sweeney in a bra. She really needs to drum up publicity for that.
By the way, I want to give props to Lisa. Did you see what this was labeled in the grab bag? Bra and order.
That was all Rich. That was all Rich.
Oh, it's all Rich. Great job, guys.
You have no idea how much time I spend making these titles pun worthy. It's a lot of pressure. Well, did you see the McConaughey one? Did you like that one?
Yeah, I did.
That was How to Lose a Trademark in 10 Years. Speaking of a movie title called How to Lose a Guy in ten days. That was a guy in 10 days. So that was a famous rom-com between Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson. Sydney Sweeney was recently in a rom-com with Glenn Powell entitled Anyone But You, I believe. So we're going to go around the horn and ask you on the spot to name your favorite rom-com of all time. This can't be as hard as some of the recent questions we've asked our guests. The caveat is, whoever goes last is in trouble because you cannot repeat an answer that someone earlier gave. Out of deference to our guest, we're going to put Dana first and give you the first crack. What is your famous non-Anyone But You, non-How to Lose a Guy rom-com of all time?
I think it's got to be Pretty Woman. I mean, I guess, does that qualify as a rom-com? I don't know.
100%. It's definitely a rom-com.
I mean, it's just there's some great lines in there. And, you know, I think both, you know, Julia and Richard play awesome roles.
Excellent choice. Rachel, favorite rom-com of all time?
Oh, my God. I like them all. I mean, I think I'm a Hugh Grant fan. And so there are so many of those, like, bumbling cutie rom-coms. I'll go with Notting Hill.
Nice. Notting Hill. All right. Very good. Ryan Burrow, I know you are a sucker for a weepy rom-com. What's your favorite?
I'm actually going to go a little bit more on the comedy side. 50 First Dates. Adam Sandler,
yeah,
Barrymore.
Yeah. That's a good one. Lisa, favorite rom-com?
I'm going to keep with the Adam Sandler and say just go with it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I just saw that recently.
Well, I'm going to zag a little. And one of my favorite movies of all time is, I think, could be classified as a rom-com. And it's Ted. You know, the relationship between Ted and Wahlberg. I don't think you could classify that as anything less than romantic, and it's a comedy, so I'm going to go with. Like
it seems like you're floating into Die Hard's a Christmas movie territory here. Like you're really trying to, you know, make the most of it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but
you're just trying to say Ted.
Did Lisa get hers in?
Lisa said,
"Oh, that's yes. right. That's
just
right.
go with it.
Just go Let's with go, it.
Just go with it. That's right. All right. All right. Lisa, thank you so much. Ben Anderson, thank you so much. Also, special thanks to our grab bag guests, Dana Applegate and Rachel Fizay. And we had Mitchell Eppner of KTAP LLP, Dean Michael Scharf with Case Western Reserve School of Law, and Antonio Romanucci of Romanucci and Bland. And for Rich Lenkoff, I'm Brian Burrow. Tina Martini was on assignment this week. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.